Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
Um zu verstehen, was heute passiert, müssen wir wissen, was bisher geschah.
Genau dafür gibt es unseren neuen Geschichtspodcast. Von politischen Intrigen im antiken Rom über die fanatischen Sektenführer in der frühen Neuzeit bis hin zu den großen Eroberern des Mongolischen Reichs und ihren Management-Skills.
Ich bin Joachim Telgenbischer.
Ich bin Nils Minkmar.
Und wir finden heraus, was bisher geschah, um zu verstehen, was heute passiert. Höre, was bisher geschah, überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.
I'm Dr. Zoe Williams and I'm currently stood in a reasonably quiet street in London, in front of an unassuming building. And the reason I'm stood here is because there's a blue plaque on the wall. And it reads, Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, 1836 to 1917, the first woman to qualify as a doctor in Britain, lived here. And not only did she live here, but she also set up her first medical practice here. Interestingly, she set it up in her home because nobody would let her work as a doctor anywhere else. She was an absolute trailblazer. It's sad, really, and I'm sure she would be very disappointed that over 150 years later, it's only now that we're starting to recognise and pick apart just how much women as patients have been underserved by the medical profession. Hello, I'm Dr. Zoe Williams, a general practitioner in the UK, the equivalent of a primary care or family physician. And this is the documentary, His and Hers Medicine, from the BBC World Service. I've been aware for some time that the medical profession around the world has treated men and women as if they're the same, both mentally and physically. From the way medical students are taught, to the way doctors diagnose women and men, and the way they then treat them. But men and women's bodies are not the same. And in this programme, I'm going to look at how women have been suffering and sometimes dying because there's been no understanding or acknowledgement of the fact that we are not just little men.
In history, the male body was always used as the default body in the Americas and in Europe.
This is Dr. Vera Regit-Zagrosek, Professor of Cardiology at the University of Zurich and Director of the Institute of Gender in Medicine at the University of Charité in Berlin.
A female body or brain did not exist outside the sexual organs, outside of the what we call bikini triangle.
The triangle is the one you would have if you drew a line between the breasts and a line from each breast to the female reproductive organs.
The differences are actually everywhere, in every single cell of our brain, our heart, our liver. Every single cell in the female body has two X chromosomes, and in the male body has an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. The X has much more genes that are related to heart function, brain function, liver function. The second issue are the sex hormones. They are active also in all our organs, in the brain, in the heart, in the muscles. And they drive more growth processes in the men, testosterone, but in the women, they are more responsible for repair, conservation, and this also makes in every single cell a difference between women and men.
I was certainly never taught about these differences when I was a medical student, and it's something that, to be honest, I haven't given that much thought to until quite recently. But having said that, when it's explained in this way, it does make perfect sense. In fact, it seems so obvious that it has me questioning, why is this knowledge new to me? On reflecting back to my medical school education, the normal body, the body that we layered all of our knowledge onto, was almost always a male body. The textbooks had images of mostly male bodies. The research was done on mostly male bodies. But that was a while ago, so surely things have changed by now. So I'm here today in a medical library. I've come to have a look at a very specific book. It's known amongst us medics and medical students as the Bible. We've all had this book, and it's called Clinical Medicine by Kumar and Clark. It is huge, and it's got pretty much all the stuff you need to know to be a doctor. Now, I was at medical school 20 years ago. Gosh, that makes me feel old. So this book is now the 10th edition that I'm looking at, which was published just a few years ago in 2021. And not surprisingly, actually, whilst there are some pictures of women in here, it is predominantly photographs, images, drawings of male bodies. So, despite us knowing about the sex differences that are in every cell of our bodies, the male body is still the default body, the body that's seen as the normal body by the medical profession. But why does this matter? If there are physical differences between men and women, is it really such a big deal for women's health?
Well, it's had an adverse consequence throughout pretty much all health conditions.
This is Dr. Noelle Berry-Mertz. She's the director of the Barbra Streisand Women's Heart Center in California.
There are sex differences in lung cancer. There are sex differences in autoimmune diseases that are very profound. There are sex differences. I mean, if you just go down all of the things that we treat and diagnose, there are important differences. Women are more likely to be misdiagnosed, underdiagnosed. And again, when you can't diagnose, the physician doesn't know what to do, so they don't get treated. So it's powerful impact.
Let's start with clinical trials. Before any drug is given to us, it's tested in clinical trials, often run by drug companies. These test whether a drug is effective, if it has adverse effects on us, and to see what sort of dose we should have. So, if we've known for years that women and men's bodies are so different, then wouldn't it make sense to test any drug on both men and women? But this hasn't happened, and it's the same around the world.
The companies try to go the fastest way, and this is to take small homogeneous group, usually of young white men, and do a very clean and fast study without women, elderly, minorities.
Historically, it's been thought that women would be difficult to include in trials. They might get pregnant, and there was fear that the drugs being tested could harm the fetus. And then women might not be available as easily because they'd have childcare responsibilities. But the main reason was that they have menstrual cycles, which could interfere with the results and the costs of running the trials would increase.
I am apt to say that women are the original underserved, underrepresented population.
This is Michelle Reed, head of global demographics and diversity at the pharmaceutical company GSK.
Women were always the second class, right?
In what ways is it detrimental to women to have not been participating in these trials that have, you know, mostly been carried out on men, but then obviously women still get the same drugs prescribed in the same way, even though they haven't been tested?
Well, there's a wide range of places where it would be beneficial to have that representation. At the very core level, metabolically speaking, we've come to learn that the metabolics within a female body are not simply the same as the metabolics in a male body. If somebody has a chronic disease and they choose to or just simply are pregnant, they're now faced with a decision as to what to do with the medicine that they do or don't understand the benefits and safety around. It can be something that it sounds really good in somebody's head, but isn't, hey, let's make sure that we protect our women by not forcing them to do these experimental, you know, clinical trials. But meanwhile, rather than protecting women from trials, we should be protecting women with trials.
The company Michelle works for, GSK, is very aware of the importance of women being fairly represented in trials. They've developed diversity guidelines, they work with community and patient advocacy groups, and they train their own staff in order to address the imbalance. You're listening to His and Hers Medicine with me, Dr. Zoe Williams, from the BBC World Service. For some time now, we've known that in certain conditions and diseases, men and women tend to present differently to each other. These include cancer, hepatitis, chronic kidney, digestive, and as we'll hear, cardiovascular disease. And though some drug companies and institutions are making efforts to include more women in clinical trials, progress overall is still slow. This is true even in areas where there are acknowledged differences between men and women's biology and in their response to drugs, or what are known as interventions, which is any action taken to prevent or treat disease or improve health in other ways. And one key area is in heart disease. Dr. Liesl Zucker is Professor of Paediatric Cardiology at the Red Cross Children's Hospital in Cape Town.
What has been well recognized now with several studies is shown that cardiovascular trials, especially high impact trials, were predominantly, and I'm talking about 95% plus, run by men. Sometimes had no women on the advisory board or in the investigating team, less than 30%, sometimes even less than 10% women as participants. And then the extrapolation was directly to women for the intervention, which we know now is not appropriate.
Just recently, we had some clinical trials with only 15 or 19% women, and the drug was accepted for clinical use.
The result of this is that drugs have frequently been given to women which are either entirely inappropriate or at too high a dose.
Well, one impressive example was that an old lady, good friend of mine, absolutely brilliant old lady, called me one day and said, "It's terrible. I'm so sick. I'm so ill. I cannot out and walk and I'm breathless. I have always cold hand and feet." And I was really puzzled. And I asked, "Have you seen your doctor recently?" And yeah. And he gave me wonderful drugs. And I said, "Yes. And what drug and how much?" And then the problem was that this old lady really had an overdose of a drug, usually beneficial drug. But for her, it was an absolute overdose. And the problem was solved after the drug was reduced to about 20% of the original dose. This can happen.
Sometimes lower dosages are just not even made because women's needs have been ignored.
And I've actually seen something in my own house with my wife where there was a drug that didn't have the lower dose produced. So for her to taper off that medicine was more challenging than it needed to be because of her body weight. There are also some ethnicity considerations that we've seen for dose modifications in labels, not specifically with GSK products, but in the industry at large, that has happened because of the way different people's kidneys work and how the drugs leave your system.
And sometimes the entirely wrong drug is given to women. Dr. Liesl Zucker is aware of an example of this in the treatment of hypertension, which is also known as high blood pressure.
So hypertension is quite an interesting condition, affects, you know, millions of people across the world. And usually the way we deal with it is by titrating the drug regimen. So you start with one drug, you add the next one, you add the next one. But some of those drugs are less appropriate for women than there are for men. So we go according to this algorithm where we start with the one and then just move our way upwards and we just keep adding. And we're not aware of the fact that actually the reason why the first or the second drug even is not achieving the control that we wish is because it's a woman that's getting the drug instead of a man.
This is an interesting example that I can directly relate to in my own clinical practice. We do indeed have an algorithm which is based on guidelines and that we use to determine the best first-line drug and second-line drug to prescribe for high blood pressure. This algorithm is quite unique in that it does take into account the patient's age and ethnicity, and therefore the drug you're prescribed will often be different if you're either older than 55 or have black family origin than if you're under 55 and not black. These guidelines do not differentiate, however, based on whether you are a man or a woman. And that makes me wonder how many of them have been properly tested on women. And in some cases, even when a drug has been tested on women, the drug companies have not been transparent about the result. Dr. Barry Metz.
The most famous one is one of the sleeper drugs, the drugs that were originally developed as a sleep aid. Also sometimes are used for anxiety, short-term depression. They're not really antidepressants, but they're widely used. And it all came out because it had been approved by the FDA forever. And an investigator identified an unusually high number of accidents in women, but not in men, that were using it for sleep. And it turned out that the company actually had data that demonstrated that it wasn't a short-term drug in women, that for their differing metabolism, they still had relatively high levels of the drug in the morning when they were driving the kids to school. It was a big story.
If you take a pill to get a good night's sleep, check with your doctor. There is important new information today about the most popular sleep medicines. The Food and Drug Administration says women should be taking half as much Ambien and other pills containing the same ingredient. The recommendation.
The makers of the sleeping pills were forced to alter their dosage advice to women. And since the early 90s, the FDA in the United States has brought in legislation to enforce adequate representation of women in clinical trials. But there have been concerns that the legislation isn't monitored or enforced and there is still an imbalance. And it's also important to state that the lack of women in clinical trials is partly due to a worldwide reluctance on the part of women to participate in them. Sometimes it's because trials are not run at times that accommodate women, but also there's a lack of trust amongst many women in the medical profession itself. So people like Michelle Reed and his company GSK have to make a real effort to recruit women.
You're talking to people who more often than not go to a doctor and may not have the best experience for whatever reason. There might be sexism, there might be a sense of being condescended to, belittled. Oh, you're just not smart enough to have this conversation with me. I'm a smart doctor and you're not. And any of those experiences that have ever happened in the past are going to impact how you look at a clinical trial. And we recognize that.
The way that the medical profession treats women is often just an extension of how the society they're operating in treats women as a whole. It's a societal and cultural issue as well as a medical one. A good illustration of how prejudices about women can bleed over into how they're treated by health services is when it comes to the issue of pain. Joanna Burke is a professor of history at the University of London and spent a lot of time researching the subject for her book, The History of Pain.
The pain of women is treated very differently to the pain of men. What we find if we look back in the past is that women are in a catch-22 situation. On the one hand, they are seen by medical professionals as being exquisitely sensitive to pain. But on the other hand, they are seen as somehow having this capacity to suffer pain without complaining. Now, what this means is that if they're acutely sensitive to pain, then there are arguments that, well, actually, it's exaggerated pain. Therefore, we shouldn't encourage it, so we give them fewer analgesics, less pain relief. So historically, you get arguments that God created women's bodies to be able to bear pain more easily because they have to suffer pain in childbirth. Now, what that does is it creates real problems in terms of ideas about treating women in childbirth pain, for example.
So there are these conflicting beliefs about women and pain, that they're more sensitive to pain at the same time as being able to bear more pain. And these beliefs are both added up to not really believing women when they say they're in pain. And then there's another layer of prejudice on top of that.
Women of colour were believed to be less sensitive to the pains, the pangs of childbirth. And therefore, of course, they were given fewer analgesics. There was this idea that somehow women of colour, women from the working classes, poor women, minoritised women generally have a different physiological body that enabled them to give birth with less pain. What I find really shocking is that so many of these ideas about this chain of feeling persist today.
In the last few years, pain and the study of it has become a hot topic, partly because of the rising incidence of what's called chronic pain. Now, this is pain that persists beyond the usual recovery period or occurs long term alongside a medical condition like arthritis. And for many years, there's been an acknowledgement that more and more women are suffering from chronic pain. But it's been put down to cultural or gender-based reasons.
My name is Carol Torsney, and I'm a researcher based at the University of Edinburgh. And we're interested in how the nervous system processes pain, and in particular, if there are any differences between the sexes.
As in many other branches of medicine, women's pain was an under-researched area.
Essentially, the majority of preclinical research actually focused on male subjects. So there weren't actually that many studies that compared the sexes. In our particular field, the pain field, there was a genuine belief that the actual biology of the pain system would be similar, and that the sex differences were more to do with gender roles, expectation, maybe sex differences in pain experience, as I mentioned, or maybe sex differences in psychological coping strategies. So it wasn't really considered that the biology could be different.
But Carol's research has thrown up some surprising, possibly groundbreaking results.
My research has shown that the nerves that detect and communicate pain to the spinal cord and brain so that we experience it, that those pain nerves, they signal that pain differently between males and females. And also in chronic pain conditions, that signaling is altered, and the way it's altered depends on whether you're female or male.
So once again, there are clear physical sex differences. The research is in its early stages, and it's not yet known what this means in terms of the responses of men and women to pain. But perhaps what it does mean is that when women report their pain, it's not something that should be ignored. You're listening to His and Hers Medicine from the BBC World Service with me, Dr. Zoe Williams. Coming up in the second half of the programme, I'm going to be looking at something that most women don't really think affects them. But in actual fact, it's the world's biggest killer of women. And that's cardiovascular disease and heart attacks. So join me again in a few moments and hear how the risk factors and symptoms of heart disease can be different for men and women. And how a lack of awareness about the prevalence of women's heart disease amongst women and medical staff is contributing to unnecessary deaths.
Um zu verstehen, was heute passiert, müssen wir wissen, was bisher geschah.
Genau dafür gibt es unseren neuen Geschichtspodcast. Von politischen Intrigen im antiken Rom über die fanatischen Sektenführer in der frühen Neuzeit bis hin zu den großen Eroberern des Mongolischen Reichs und ihren Management-Skills.
Ich bin Joachim Telgenbischer.
Ich bin Nils Minkmar.
Und wir finden heraus, was bisher geschah, um zu verstehen, was heute passiert. Höre, was bisher geschah, überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar mit dem Code TARA60.
Welcome back to the documentary His and Hers Medicine from the BBC World Service with me, Dr. Zoe Williams. There's one area of health where the medical profession is demonstrably failing women, and that's heart disease. You might be surprised to learn that it's the number one killer of women around the world, and the reasons for this are varied and multi-layered. I'm going to investigate why so many women, thousands of women, are dying needlessly every year. And how is it that men's mortality rates from heart disease are going down whilst women's are going up? Dr. Sonia Babu-Narayan is the Associate Medical Director at the British Heart Foundation and she's a consultant cardiologist.
Heart attacks are often considered as a man's disease and commonly I find the thing that shocks women is when they're told that coronary heart disease kills twice as many women as breast cancer.
I've got the numbers written down here. So 35,000 women are admitted following a heart attack in the UK every year, which is 98 a day, which is 4 every hour. So this is not something that's rare. This is very, very common. How does that compare to men?
It's true that men have more heart attacks, are more likely to have a heart attack. And that when women have heart attacks, it's more common that that's as much as 10 years or more later in terms of age than men. But something being less common is not the same as something being uncommon. So this is a really important global story.
And as Dr. Babu-Narayan says, this is a global story. Professor Liesl Zulke is Professor of Paediatric Cardiology at the Red Cross Children's Hospital in Cape Town. And she's the vice president of the Lancet Commission of Cardiovascular Disease in Women. She was one of the pioneers into researching sex differences in how the heart functions.
So the number one cause of death in South Africa still remains HIV and HIV with TB, but the fastest increase is cardiovascular disease, and that is the next highest. And if we project out what is going to happen in the next 5 years, cardiovascular disease will be, like it is in the global world, it will be the number one killer. And that is particularly so in women.
It's only very recently that the medical profession considered there might be a difference in the way that men's and women's hearts function. Dr. Noelle Berry-Mertz is the director of the Barbra Streisand Women's Heart Center in California.
There was already certain aspects in cardiology that were described as important sex differences. The way that the pumping function changed with exercise was already well described as quite different between women and men. And I thought, how curious that this is well described. We use it in our diagnostic thresholds, and yet no one really knows why. Why is this pumping function different? It was pretty important, and yet, you know, nobody was doing it.
And I guess so there, that was almost a springboard then, I guess, by the sound of it, to think, well, it can't just be the pumping function of the heart.
You know, we have to say, why would women and men be different? And a lot of it likely does have to do with the differences in reproduction. And I like to say, you know, women are built to last. They have better stem cells because we have to be able to make things like babies. We have obviously different hormone levels. And just to start out, you know, why would the pumping function be better or different in women and men? Well, think about a pregnancy. You know, women need to be able to not go into heart failure when they support pumping blood for two. We have stiffer hearts, again, so we don't go into heart failure when we're pregnant, and we respond differently to stress. We do better with stress. So evolution, you know, made us different.
And I wondered why she thought it was so important to create a heart center specifically for women.
We had been doing the research for 10 plus years, identifying things that were clearly translatable, and yet I did not see any pickup in community care. I did not see guidelines being reformulated. And so we said, okay, we'll do those trials.
Another early pioneer in looking at sex differences in cardiology is Dr. Vera Regit-Zakrosek, a cardiologist and director of the Institute of Gender in Medicine in Germany. She noticed problems with the way that women were being treated more than 30 years ago when she was working in a heart center.
We had a woman dying in our German heart center at Munich, and no one could give me a conclusive answer why this woman was dying. And finally, one of the supervisors said, "This is a woman. We don't understand it." And then we did a study on the outcome of coronary bypass surgery, a retrospective analysis of our database in 20,000 patients. And we found that the survival of women after heart surgery, coronary artery surgery, was only about half of the survival of age-matched men. I was rather shocked, and then I really started to get more data on this issue.
Through the work of people like Dr. Barry Mertz and Dr. Regit-Zakrosek, the medical profession is much more aware of the differences in the hearts of men and women. But this knowledge has not, it seems, translated into better treatments for women. So, first of all, do we get heart disease for the same reasons as men?
So us women are unlucky enough to share all the same risk factors, but also have some of our own to add on top. If you put on a lot of weight and you become obese, if you develop diabetes, if you smoke. But did you know that having diabetes or smoking is worse if you're a woman? It's a stronger association with developing, with the future chance of having a heart attack. So even the same risk factors can be different in women and men. And then we women have some additional risk factors that are unique to us because of our sex. And these are related to what I call periods and pregnancy, can have a long-term relevance. So what do I mean? If you got your periods early, if you went into menopause early, if you had recurrent miscarriages, stillbirth, premature birth, if you've had high blood pressure or diabetes during your pregnancy, these things that feel like they belong in the reproductive years of your life and can easily be forgotten as you age and get asked questions about risk factors and shockingly are not systematically asked in any of our medical scoring algorithms.
It's quite shocking, really, that I, as a family doctor, am not fully aware of these extra risk factors for women. But that's because I've never been taught. Medical education is taught in a really structured way. And when I learnt the list of questions relating to risk factors for heart disease at medical school, these were not included. And then again, during specialist training to become a GP, no. Dr. Barbara Narayan raises an important point that as GPs, we can't be expected to know everything. And we do have clever technology that helps us. In this case, it's a technology that automatically generates an estimated risk of a patient having a heart attack or a stroke based on the information stored in their medical record. It's called a Q-risk calculator. You can even go online yourself and check your own risk. It includes age, ethnicity, family history, smoking status, BMI and medical history. It even includes your postcode because this helps estimate your affluence. And whilst it does include your sex, it does not include data regarding when your period started, any history of premature birth, miscarriages, stillbirth, high blood pressure or diabetes during pregnancy or your age of menopause. All factors, which I just learned, are important and mostly should be available from the medical record. There's also something else to consider when thinking about why so many women are getting heart disease around the world, and that's lifestyle. Where countries are undergoing urbanisation and there's increasing social mobility, there's a correlation in a rise in the risk factors that we've heard cause heart disease. Dr. Lee Salsulka.
Diabetes in particular is rapidly increasing in the African and South African population in women. We're seeing women change their style of work. So instead of maybe work around the house or work closer to home, they now traveling to work, which means they're using public transport or private transport, which is a sedentary way of getting to work. There is another important factor, which is perhaps sometimes under-recognized, and that is the contribution of psychosocial stresses on our cardiovascular system. We are all under a lot more pressure, I think, than we were perhaps in the past. I'm well aware of the fact that at this age, my mother had retired already, and I'm in, you know, probably the height of my career.
You're listening to me, Dr. Zoe Williams, and His and Hers Medicine from the BBC World Service. In many countries, there have been huge improvements in the treatment of heart disease. So why are so many women dying from it?
Over the last decades, there's been fantastic research and innovation in healthcare that means the chances of surviving a heart attack, a disease that you used to lie in bed, have oxygen, and there couldn't be much treatment for, are now really, really good. If you can get timely treatment and the right care, your survival is really good. But it pains me, both as a cardiologist and as a woman, to know that women may find themselves unable to access that same high quality of care and outcomes as men, seemingly because the odds are stacked against them for being a woman. And that seems to be due to a mixture of factors. They're more likely to be underaware that a heart attack could happen to them too. They're more likely to be underdiagnosed or worse, misdiagnosed, having something else, say a panic attack. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to be undertreated or under-supported after the heart attack in terms of access to cardiac rehabilitation. And they're more likely to be underrepresented in the research that tells us what to do and how to treat patients because fewer women participate in research.
Something else that's a problem is how people imagine what a heart attack looks like. My guess is that most people, if asked to imagine someone having a heart attack, would envisage the so-called Hollywood heart attack. The media's portrayal tends to be of a middle-aged man, usually white, clutching his chest, gasping for air and dropping to the ground. Now, I remember the first patient that rewrote that scenario in my mind. It was when I was a medical student in Newcastle, in the northeast of England, where people are very passionate about their football. And this particular patient came into A&E, not on a stretcher, in a wheelchair. He was a white man in his 60s, and he was sat upright and talking to me. He was telling me how he'd refused to let his wife call the ambulance until the end of the football game. So he'd actually been sat at home watching the TV, knowing he was having a heart attack, for 20 whole minutes until the final whistle blew before they called the ambulance. And when I asked him how much pain he was in, he told me that it wasn't really pain, but felt more like an elephant was sat on his chest. He'd had a heart attack before, you see, and this was exactly the same as the first time. So this patient opened my eyes to the fact that heart attacks don't always present like they do in the movies. Having said that, until recently, the image that I myself would still paint in my mind of what a heart attack looks like, well, it would still be a middle-aged white man, possibly clutching his chest. And I think that is actually the same for most people out there.
I guess they, like, clutch their chest and they fall over.
Well, I see someone, a man, normally, on the floor, his body convulsing. Definitely some clutching of the chest going on.
Somebody grabbing onto their chest, their breathing gets quite heavy.
Chest pain. Crushing chest pain, struggling to breathe, can't focus, can't do anything, and it's the whole wanting to curl up into a ball.
I imagine someone clutching their chest and, like, screaming, like, oh, very violent.
In fact, the signs you're having a heart attack are just not as straightforward as they are in the movies. And they're much more varied in both men and women.
Not everybody even uses the word pain. It is defined by pain, suddenly coming on in the centre of your chest. But it's far more common that people will describe discomfort, heaviness, gripping, tightness, something pulling, a band.
And some research indicates that women have other symptoms as well as discomfort in the chest.
They present with other symptoms, often gastrointestinal symptoms, such as nausea or a feeling of dyspepsia, anxiety, that acute feeling that there's something terrible happening, which can look like a panic attack. And then sometimes even just acute fatigue or tiredness over a period of time. And that also is often allocated to work stress or life stress at that particular age.
Because these symptoms are not the typical symptoms that most people associate with a male heart attack, and because women just don't expect to be having a heart attack, they're often completely unaware when they're having one themselves.
I think we might go to Hawksmoor.
Esther Stanhope lives in London with her family. Her dad had died of a heart attack when he was just 42, but Esther was very fit and active and never thought of herself as being at risk.
So I was in New York and I found myself speaking at this event, and after the event I was walking down the street, it was quite warm in Manhattan, and I remember thinking, I can't breathe properly, maybe I've got asthma or something, or I'm allergic to something. And I met my sister-in-law in New York, and I told her, I just feel a bit strange, I'm a bit clammy and finding it a bit difficult to breathe. And she said, oh, a friend of mine had a panic attack. And so for some reason I thought, oh, maybe it's a panic attack. You can imagine when you read about heart attacks, male heart attacks, they say it feels like an elephant on the chest. It didn't feel like that. It wasn't even a kitten on the chest. It was just a really mild feeling. And I had a slight numbing in my left arm, and I went to this CrossFit class, and my sister-in-law said, come on, you know, join in. And I was trying to do these burpees, which is these squats holding weights with these army people trying to, like, and I felt so ill. And I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to faint in a minute. I felt like I was going to be sick. I can walk this off. Just breathe. You'll be fine. You'll be fine.
Esther flew back to London without having seen a doctor. And when she told her husband she felt so ill, he told her to phone the doctor.
I rang up the GP surgery. And of course, they have their list of questions. So their questions go, one, have you got heart disease in your family? Yes. Have you been on a long haul flight? Yes. Have you had a feeling in your chest or pain in your chest? Well, not a pain, but just a small kind of feeling. Yes. Have you had any numbness in your left arm? Well, not loads, but maybe a little bit. Right. Go straight to A&E. So I walked to A&E. Can you believe it? So we got to A&E and we told them the symptoms. And I think obviously as soon as they start filling out the form, it's like possible heart issues. And I was looking at my watch. I said, I've got a meeting, a call at 3 o'clock. Do you think we finish by then? And one of the cardiologists said to me, she said, you know, you're being treated for a heart attack. And I said, what? Come on.
Esther was lucky in that the medical team immediately recognised that she was having a heart attack and she had a stent fitted. Now, that's a small wire mesh tube that acts like a scaffold and keeps the artery open. And she was very lucky that, thankfully, she did make a full recovery. But there are some women whose pain is, well, just dismissed. And sometimes it's not just because they're women. There are other prejudices at work here too. Before Sonia Babu Narayan began her journey into the medical profession, she went with her mother to the hospital when her mother was experiencing extreme pain in her back and chest.
But my mother, I now know, was having symptoms of a heart attack. She also had pain in her back, but she also had pain in her chest. And the last time I saw my mother alive, she was weeping with the pain. And as her daughter, in the coronary care unit, I was told, oh, Indian women always complain of pain. She's already on pain relief. And I would love to tell you that kind of communication doesn't happen anymore. I always thought that was some strange anomaly or outlier or rotten apple in the cart. But we do hear this again and again that people do experience being dismissed or just not being believed in heart attack care, but also in other women's health care.
I think as you were talking there, the one statistic that is just at the forefront of my mind is that here in the UK, if you're a black woman, you're 3 times more likely to die in pregnancy than your white counterparts. And that, again, it's largely a lot of that is down to the experience of pain and whether or not a woman is believed when she fears that something is wrong.
Exactly. It's the example I often think of. It's terrible that that's an example we both know because it's so true and pervasive.
A heart attack happens when a blood clot causes a blockage in one of the arteries that takes oxygenated blood to the muscle of your heart. And it's imperative that that blockage is treated as quickly as possible, because the longer that heart muscle goes without oxygen, the less likely it is to ever function well again, if at all.
And you have got a period, about an hour at least, where you can do something about that. So you can melt the clot, you can remove the clot. There are various ways of getting rid of that clot within a very short period of time. And that will rescue that muscle to be able to recover from that small period where they didn't get enough oxygen and enough blood. If you miss that period, that muscle is going to die.
This short window of time is known as the golden hour. And because women don't recognise they're having a heart attack, and sometimes even the medical professionals don't recognise it, women are often not getting the treatment they need soon enough. A global systematic review found that the average delay between the onset of symptoms and arrival at hospital for men ranges between 1 hour 24 minutes and 3 hours 30 minutes. Compared to women, which is between 1 hour 48 minutes and 7 hours 12 minutes. And this makes a huge difference to survival rates and to the extent of damage to the heart. But even if women do get to A&E, there are another set of reasons why she might not survive when a man would have done. Sometimes even the medical professionals don't recognise that the patient in front of them is having a heart attack. Often a suspected heart attack patient will be given an angiogram, which is a type of x-ray to assess blood vessels. It involves a thin tube being inserted into a larger artery, which can then be guided to the arteries which supply the heart, and it releases some dye, which can be seen clearly on the x-ray. A coronary angiogram can diagnose atherosclerosis. This is narrowing of the arteries from formation of plaque, which would mean you're at risk of having a heart attack. Unfortunately, this is not a procedure that's designed to pick up heart attacks in women. Dr. Barry Mertz.
Women and men have a different deposition of the plaque in their coronary arteries. The men have a lot more, and it results in what's called lumpy bumpy disease that we detect easily with an angiogram. The women distribute it diffusely throughout the coronary artery. It's hard to see on a traditional angiogram. Sometimes they look completely normal. His plaque, lumpy bumpy, often will rupture and cause a big heart attack. Her plaque more often will erode and cause a very small heart attack that until recently we often didn't even detect with our chemical assays. We have much better ones now. The troponin assays are much more sensitive. We're picking up more heart attacks in women. But again, it's an important sex difference.
There's already evidence to show that not only might a woman delay presenting to healthcare with the same symptom, but there's also a difference in the care she might receive. But it's more common that a woman might just be assumed not to be having a heart attack. And so things happen a bit slower. We know there are data to say they less commonly get a stent, a small metal cage inflated in the blocked coronary artery to restore blood supply. Or if they do get one, it can more often be delayed. They less commonly have heart surgery. We know from data before the pandemic, and if anything, we think it may be worse, have been worse during the pandemic, that fewer women are put on the standard medicines that you should be put on after a heart attack, including, for example, medicine to lower your cholesterol, statins. These are not expensive anymore.
So how can that be, that women are discharged without a statin, which is cost pennies, cost nothing, and can significantly reduce their risk of having further heart attacks in the future, and they are at higher risk, significantly higher risk of having another heart attack if they don't receive proper treatment?
I can't explain that to you, except that I don't think that sounds acceptable, and there must be something that we haven't got right in the system. But I can't explain why that's happened to an individual woman or not. It just seems to me part of this story of lots of small but cumulative differences in the way a higher chance of a misdiagnosis, a higher chance of not accessing the same amount of treatments, not accessing the same amount of care afterwards, and being underrepresented in general adds up to thousands of potential lives that could have been saved in the UK.
So we've known then for some time that women are getting a raw deal from the medical profession. So I asked Dr. Barbara Narayan why it's taking so long for things to change. And her response was one that was actually echoed by all of the female experts that we spoke to from around the world.
Our workforce doesn't represent the people that we serve. And if you look at, it's not just the UK. And we know, because there's absolutely crystal clear evidence, that diverse teams with diverse cognition, diverse life experience, diverse values lead to better research and better innovation. That better research and better innovation leads to better care, and that better care will mean more lives saved and improved and more women with healthy outcomes, because everyone is having better outcomes.
Dr. Lee Solsulka.
New things are difficult for the medical profession. We struggle to take what we see from data and immediately apply it. The thing is that we know this now. We can't say, oh, because it's complex, because it's multidisciplinary, we can't do anything about it. The point is actually being faced with some of the stark numbers, and it's time to change that trajectory.
You've been listening to His and Hers Medicine from the BBC World Service with me, Dr. Zoe Williams. The producer was Alison Vernon-Smith, and it was a Just Radio production.